Lord Balaban saw the ape's rude behavior and thought of the disruptions he had created in the surrounding kingdoms. Thus the Lord angrily took up his club and his plow weapon, having decided to put his enemy to death. Mighty Dravida also came forward to do battle. Uprooting a shala tree with one hand, he rushed toward Balaram and struck him on the head with the tree trunk. But Lord Balaram remained as motionless as a mountain and simply grabbed the log as it fell upon his head. He then struck Dravida with his club, named Sunanda. Struck on the skull by the Lord's club, Dravida became brilliantly decorated by the outpour of blood, like a mountain beautified by red oxide. Ignoring the wound, Dravida uprooted another tree, stripped it of leaves by brute force, and struck the Lord again. Now enraged, Lord Balaram shattered the tree into hundreds of pieces, upon which Dravida grabbed yet another tree and furiously hit the Lord again. This tree, too, the Lord smashed into hundreds of pieces. Thus fighting the Lord, who again and again demolished the trees he was attacked with, Dravida kept on uprooting trees from all sides until the forest was left treeless. The angry ape then released a rain of stones upon Lord Balaram, but the wielder of the club easily pulverized them all. Dravida, the most powerful of apes, now clenched his fists at the end of his palm tree-sized arms, came before Lord Balaram, and beat his fists against the Lord's body. The furious Lord of the Yadavas then threw aside his club and plow, and with his bare hands hammered a blow upon Dravida's collarbone. The ape collapsed, vomiting blood. When he fell, Rivataka Mountain shook, along with its cliffs and trees, like a wind-tossed boat at sea. In the heavens, the demigods, perfect mystics, and great sages cried out, "Victory to you! Obeisances to you! Excellent! Well done!" and showered flowers upon the Lord. Having thus killed Dravida, who had disturbed the whole world, the Supreme Lord returned to his capital as the people along the way chanted his glories. Chapter 68, The Marriage of Sambha. Shukadeva Goswami said, "O King, Jambapati's son Sambha, ever victorious in battle, kidnapped Duryodhana's daughter Lakshmana from her Swayamvara ceremony." The angry Kuru said, "This ill-behaved boy has offended us, forcibly kidnapping our unmarried daughter against her will. Arrest this ill-behaved Sambha. What will the Vrishnis do? By our grace, they are ruling land that we have granted them. If the Vrishnis come here when they learn that their son has been captured, we will break their pride. Thus they'll become subdued, like bodily senses brought under strict control." After saying this and having their plan sanctioned by the senior member of the Kuru dynasty, Karna, Shala, Bhuri, Yajnaketu, and Suyodhana set out to attack Sambha. Seeing Duryodhana and his companions rushing toward him, Sambha, the great chariot fighter, took up his splendid bow and stood alone like a lion. Determined to capture him, the angry bowmen led by Karna shouted at Sambha, "Stand and fight! Stand and fight!" They came straight for him and showered him with arrows. O best of the Kurus, as Karna's son Sambha was being unjustly harassed by the Kurus, that darling of the Yadu dynasty did not tolerate their attack, any more than a lion would tolerate an attack by puny animals. Twanging his wonderful bow, heroic Sambha struck with arrows the six warriors headed by Karna. He pierced the six chariots with as many arrows, each team of four horses with four arrows, and each chariot driver with a single arrow, and he similarly struck the great bowmen who commanded the chariots. The enemy warriors congratulated Sambha for this display of prowess. But they forced him down from his chariot, and thereupon four of them struck his four horses, one of them struck down his chariot driver, and another broke his bow. Having deprived Sambha of his chariot during the fight, the Kuru warriors tied him up with great difficulty, and then returned victorious to their city, taking the young boy and their princess. When the Yadavas heard news of this from Sri Narada, they became angry. Urged on by King Ugrasen, they prepared for war against the Kurus. Lord Balaram, however, cooled the tempers of the Vrishni heroes, who had already put on their armor. He who purifies the age of quarrel did not want a quarrel between the Kurus and the Vrishnis. Thus, accompanied by Brahmins and family elders, he went to Hastinapur on his chariot, which was as effulgent as the sun. As he went, he appeared like the moon surrounded by the ruling planets. Upon arriving at Hastinapur, Lord Balaram remained in a garden outside the city and sent Uddhava ahead to probe King Dhritarashtra's intentions. After he had offered proper respects to Dhritarashtra and to Bhishma, Drona, Vahlika, and Duryodhana, Uddhava informed them that Lord Balaram had arrived. Overjoyed to hear that Balaram, their dearmost friend, had come, they first honored Uddhava and then went forth to meet the Lord, carrying auspicious offerings in their hands. They approached Lord Balaram and worshipped him with gifts of cows and agya, as was fitting. Those among the Kurus who understood his true power bowed down to him, touching their heads to the ground. After both parties had heard that their relatives were doing well, and both had inquired into each other's welfare and health, Lord Balaram forthrightly spoke to the Kurus as follows. King Ugrasen is our master and the ruler of kings. With undivided attention, you should hear what he has ordered you to do, and then you should do it at once. King Ugrasen has said, even though by irreligious means several of you defeated a single opponent who follows the religious codes, still I am tolerating this for the sake of unity among family members. Upon hearing these words of Lord Baladev's, which were full of potency, courage, and strength, and were appropriate to his transcendental power, the Kauravas became furious and spoke as follows. Oh, how amazing this is! The force of time is indeed insurmountable! A lowly shoe now wants to climb on the head that bears the royal crown. It is because these Vrishnis are bound to us by marital ties that we have granted them equality, allowing them to share our beds, seats, and meals. Indeed, it is we who have given them their royal thrones. Only because we looked the other way could they enjoy the pair of yak-tail fans and the conch-shell white umbrella throne and royal bed. No longer should the Yadavs be allowed to use these royal symbols, which now cause trouble for those who gave them, like milk fed to poisonous snakes. Having prospered by our grace, these Yadavas have now lost all shame and are daring to command us. How would even Indra dare usurp anything that Bhishma, Drona, Arjuna, or the other Kurus have not given him? It would be like a lamb claiming the lion's kill. Sri Bhadarayani said, O best of the Bharatas, after the arrogant Kurus, thoroughly puffed up by the opulence of their high birth and relations, had spoken these harsh words to Balaram, they turned and went back to their city. Seeing the bad character of the Kurus and hearing their nasty words, the infallible Lord Balaram became filled with rage. His countenance frightful to behold, he laughed repeatedly and spoke as follows. Clearly, the many passions of these scoundrels have made them so proud that they do not want peace. Then let them be pacified by physical punishment, as animals are with a stick. Ah, only gradually was I able to calm the furious Yadus and Lord Krishna, who was also enraged. Desiring peace for these Kauravas, I came here. But they are so dull-headed, fond of quarrel and mischievous by nature, that they have repeatedly disrespected me. Out of conceit, they dare to address me with harsh words. King Ugrasen, the lord of the Bhojas, Vrishnis, and Andakas, is not fit to command when Indra and other planetary rulers obey his orders. That same Krishna who occupies the Sudharma assembly hall and for his enjoyment took the Parijata tree from the immortal demigods, that very Krishna is indeed not fit to sit on a royal throne. The goddess of fortune herself, ruler of the entire universe, worships his feet. And the master of the goddess of fortune does not deserve the paraphernalia of a mortal king. The dust of Krishna's lotus feet, which is the source of holiness for all places of pilgrimage, is worshipped by all the great demigods. The principal deities of all planets are engaged in his service, and they consider themselves most fortunate to take the dust of the lotus feet of Krishna on their crowns. Great demigods like Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, and even the goddess of fortune and I, are simply parts of his spiritual identity, and we also carefully carry that dust on our heads. And still, Krishna is not fit to use the royal insignia or even sit on the royal throne? We Vrishnis enjoy only whatever small parcel of land the Kurus allow us, and we are indeed shoes, whereas the Kurus are the head? Just see how these puffed-up Kurus are intoxicated with their so-called power, like ordinary drunken men. What actual ruler with the power to command would tolerate their foolish, nasty words? Today I shall rid the earth of the Kauravas, declared the furious Balaram. Thus he took his plow weapon and rose up as if to set the three worlds ablaze. The Lord angrily dug up Hastinapur with the tip of his plow and began to drag it, intending to cast the entire city into the Ganges. Seeing that their city was tumbling about like a raft at sea as it was being dragged away, and that it was about to fall into the Ganges, the Kauravas became terrified. To save their lives, they approached the Lord for shelter, taking their families with them. Placing Samba and Lakshmana in front, they joined their palms in supplication. The Kauravas said, O Rama, Rama, foundation of everything, we know nothing of your power. Please excuse our offense, for we are ignorant and misguided. You alone caused the creation, maintenance, and annihilation of the cosmos, and of you there is no prior cause. Indeed, O Lord, authorities say that the worlds are mere playthings for you as you perform your pastimes. O unlimited one of a thousand heads, as your pastime you carry this earthly globe upon one of your heads. At the time of annihilation, you withdraw the entire universe within your body, and, remaining all alone, lie down to rest. Your anger is meant for instructing everyone. It is not a manifestation of hatred or envy. O Supreme Lord, you sustain the pure mode of goodness, and you become angry only to maintain and protect this world. We bow down to you, O soul of all beings, O wielder of all potencies, O tireless maker of the universe. Offering you obeisances, we take shelter of you. Shukadev Goswami said, thus propitiated by the Kurus, whose city was trembling and who were surrendering to him in great distress, Lord Balaram became very calm and kindly disposed toward them. Do not be afraid, he said, and took away their fear. Duryodhana, being very affectionate to his daughter, gave as her dowry 1,260-year-old elephants, 120,000 horses, 6,000 golden chariots shining like the sun, and 1,000 maidservants with jeweled lockets on their necks. The Supreme Lord, chief of the Yadavas, accepted all these gifts and then departed with his son and daughter-in-law as his well-wishers bid him farewell. Then Lord Balaram entered Dwaraka and met his relatives, whose hearts were all bound to him in loving attachment. In the assembly hall, he reported to the Yadu leaders everything about his dealings with the Kurus. Even today, the city of Hastinapur is visibly elevated on its southern side along the Ganges, thus showing the signs of Lord Balaram's prowess. Chapter 69. Narada Muni visits Lord Krishna's palaces in Dwaraka. Shukadev Goswami said, hearing that Lord Krishna had killed Narakasura and had alone married many brides, Narada Muni desired to see the Lord in this situation. He thought, it is quite amazing that in a single body Lord Krishna simultaneously married 16,000 women, each in a separate palace. Thus the sage of the demigods eagerly went to Dwaraka. The city was filled with the sounds of birds and bees flying about the parks and pleasure gardens, while its lakes, crowded with blooming Indivara, Amboja, Kalvara, Kumuda, and Utpala lotuses, resounded with the calls of swans and cranes. Dwaraka boasted 900,000 royal palaces, all constructed with crystal and silver and splendorously decorated with huge emeralds. Inside these palaces, the furnishings were bedecked with gold and jewels. Traffic moved along a well-laid-out system of boulevards, roads, intersections, and marketplaces, and many assembly houses and temples of demigods graced the charming city. The roads, courtyards, commercial streets, and residential patios were all sprinkled with water and shaded from the sun's heat by banners waving from flagpoles. In the city of Dwaraka was a beautiful private quarter worshipped by the planetary rulers. This district, where the demigod Vishvakarma had shown all his divine skill, was the residential area of Lord Hari, and thus it was gorgeously decorated by the 16,000 palaces of Lord Krishna's queens. Narada Muni entered one of these immense palaces. Supporting the palace were coral pillars decoratively inlaid with vidurya gems. Sapphires bedecked the walls, and the floors glowed with perpetual brilliance. In that palace, Tushta had arranged canopies with hanging strands of pearls. There were also seats and beds fashioned of ivory and precious jewels. In attendance were many well-dressed maidservants bearing lockets on their necks, and also armor-clad guards with turbans, fine uniforms, and jeweled earrings. The glow of numerous jewel-studded lamps dispelled all darkness in the palace. My dear king, on the ornate ridges of the roof danced loudly crying peacocks, who saw the fragrant aguru incense escaping through the holes of the latticed windows and mistook it for a cloud. In that palace, the learned Brahmin saw the lord of the Satvatas, Sri Krishna, together with his wife, who fanned him with a gold-handled yak-tail fan. She personally served him in this way, even though she was constantly attended by 1,000 maidservants equal to her in personal character, beauty, youth, and fine dress. The Supreme Lord is the greatest upholder of religious principles. Thus, when he noticed Narada, he rose at once from Goddess Sri's bed, bowed his crowned head at Narada's feet, and, joining his palms, had the sage sit in his own seat. The Lord bathed Narada's feet and then put the water on his own head. Although Lord Krishna is the supreme spiritual authority of the universe and the master of his devotees, it was proper for him to behave in this way, for his name is Brahmanyadev, the Lord who favors the Brahmins. Thus Sri Krishna honored the sage Narada by bathing his feet, even though the water that bathes the Lord's own feet becomes the Ganges, the ultimate holy shrine. After fully worshipping the great sage of the demigods according to Vedic injunctions, Lord Krishna, who is himself the original sage, Narayan, the friend of Nara, conversed with Narada, and the Lord's measured speech was as sweet as nectar. Finally, the Lord asked Narada, "What may we do for you, our Lord and Master?" Sri Narada said, "O Almighty Lord, it is no surprise that you, the ruler of all worlds, show friendship for all people and yet subdue the envious. As we well know, you descend by your sweet will in order to bestow the highest good on this universe by maintaining and protecting it. Thus your glories are widely sung. Now I have seen your feet, which grant liberation to your devotees, which even Lord Brahma and other great personalities of unfathomable intelligence can only meditate upon within their hearts, and which those who have fallen into the well of material existence resort to for deliverance. Please favor me so that I may constantly think of you as I travel about. Please grant me the power to remember you." Narada then entered the palace of another of Lord Krishna's wives. He was eager to witness the spiritual potency possessed by the master of all masters of mystic power. There he saw the Lord playing at dice with his beloved consort and his friend Uddhava. Lord Krishna worshipped Narada by standing up, offering him a seat, and so on, and then, as if he did not know, asked him, "When did you arrive? What can needy persons like us do for those who are full in themselves? In any case, my dear Brahmin, please make my life auspicious." Thus addressed, Narada was astonished. He simply stood up silently and went to another palace. This time, Naradaji saw that Lord Krishna was engaged as an affectionate father petting his small children. From there, he entered another palace and saw Lord Krishna preparing to take his bath. In one place, the Lord was offering oblations into the sacrificial fires. In another, worshipping through the 5 Mahayagyas. In another, feeding Brahmins. And in yet another, eating the remnants of food left by Brahmins. Somewhere, Lord Krishna was observing the rituals for worship at sunset by refraining from speech and quietly chanting the Gayatri Mantra. And elsewhere, he was moving about with sword and shield in the area set aside for sword practice. In one place, Lord Krishna was riding on horses, elephants, and chariots, and in another place, he was resting on his bed while bards recited his glories. Somewhere, he was consulting with royal ministers like Uddhava. And somewhere else he was enjoying in the water, surrounded by many society girls and other young women. Somewhere he was giving well-decorated cows to exalted Brahmins, and elsewhere he was listening to the auspicious narration of epic histories and Puranas. Somewhere Lord Krishna was found enjoying the company of a particular wife by exchanging joking words with her. Somewhere else he was found engaged, along with his wife, in religious ritualistic functions. Somewhere, Krishna was found engaged in matters of economic development, and somewhere else, he was found enjoying family life according to the regulative principles of the Shastras. Somewhere he was sitting alone, meditating on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is transcendental to material nature. And somewhere he was rendering menial service to his elders, offering them desirable things and reverential worship. In one place, he was planning battles in consultation with some of his advisors, and in another place, he was making peace. Somewhere, Lord Keshava and Lord Balaram were together, pondering the welfare of the pious. Narada saw Lord Krishna engaged in getting his sons and daughters married to suitable brides and bridegrooms at the appropriate time, and the marriage ceremonies were being performed with great pomp. Narada observed how Sri Krishna, the master of all yoga masters, arranged to send away his daughters and sons-in-law, and also to receive them home again at the time of great holiday celebrations. All the citizens were astonished to see these celebrations. Somewhere, Krishna was worshipping all the demigods with elaborate sacrifices, and elsewhere he was fulfilling his religious obligations by doing public welfare work, such as the construction of wells, public parks, and monasteries. In another place, he was on a hunting expedition. Mounted on his Sindhi horse and accompanied by the most heroic of the Yadus, he was killing animals meant for offering in sacrifice. Somewhere, Krishna, the Lord of mystic power, was moving about in disguise among the homes of ministers and other citizens in order to understand what each of them was thinking. Having thus seen this display of the Lord's yoga maya, Narada mildly laughed and then addressed Lord Rishikesh, who was adopting the behavior of a human being. "Now we understand your mystic potencies, which are difficult to comprehend even for great mystics, O Supreme Soul, Master of all mystic power. Only by serving your feet have I been able to perceive your powers. O Lord, please give me your leave. I will wander about the worlds which are flooded with your name, loudly singing about your pastimes, which purify the universe." The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "O Brahman, I am the speaker of religion, its performer and sanctioner. I observe religious principles to teach them to the world, my child, so do not be disturbed." Shukadev Goswami said, "Thus, in every palace, Narada saw the Lord in his same personal form, executing the transcendental principles of religion that purify those engaged in household affairs. Having repeatedly seen the vast mystic display of Lord Krishna, whose power is unlimited, the sage was amazed and filled with wonder. Lord Krishna greatly honored Narada, faithfully presenting him with gifts related to economic prosperity, sense gratification, and religious duties. Thus, fully satisfied, the sage departed, constantly remembering the Lord. In this way, Lord Narayan imitated the ways of ordinary humans, manifesting his divine potencies for the benefit of all beings. Thus he enjoyed, dear King, in the company of his 16,000 exalted consorts, who served the Lord with their shy, affectionate glances and laughter. Lord Hari is the ultimate cause of universal creation, maintenance, and destruction. My dear King, anyone who chants about, hears about, or simply appreciates the extraordinary activities he performed in this world, which are impossible to imitate, will surely develop devotion for the Supreme Lord, the bestower of liberation." Chapter 70, Lord Krishna's Daily Activities. Shukadev Goswami said, "As dawn approached, the wives of Lord Madhava, each embraced around the neck by her husband, cursed the crowing roosters. The ladies were disturbed that now they would be separated from him. The bees buzzing, caused by the fragrant breeze from the Parijata garden, roused the birds from sleep. And when the birds began to sing loudly, they woke Lord Krishna like court poets reciting his glories. Lying in her beloved's arms, Queen Vaidarbhi did not like this most auspicious hour, for it meant that she would lose his embrace. Lord Madhava would rise during the Brahma Muhurta hour and touch water. With a clear mind, he would then meditate upon himself, the single, self-luminous, unequaled, and infallible Supreme Truth, known as Brahman, who by his very nature ever dispels all contamination, and who through his personal energies, which cause the creation and destruction of this universe, manifests his own pure and blissful existence. That most saintly of personalities would then bathe in sanctified water, dress himself in lower and upper garments, and perform the entire sequence of prescribed rituals, beginning with worship at dawn. After offering oblations into the sacred fire, Lord Krishna would silently chant a Gayatri mantra. Each day the Lord worshipped the rising sun and propitiated the demigods, sages and forefathers, who are all his expansions. The self-possessed Lord would then carefully worship his elders and the Brahmins. To those well-attired Brahmins, he would offer herds of tame and peaceful cows with gold-plated horns and pearl necklaces. These cows were also dressed in fine cloth, and the fronts of their hooves were plated with silver. Providers of abundant milk, they had each given birth only once and were accompanied by their calves. Daily, the Lord gave many groups of 13,084 cows to the learned Brahmins, together with linen, deer skins, and sesame seeds. Lord Krishna would offer obeisances to the cows, Brahmins, and demigods, his elders and spiritual masters, and all living beings, all of whom are expansions of his Supreme Personality. Then he would touch auspicious things. He would decorate his body, the very ornament of human society, with his own special clothes and jewelry, and with divine flower garlands and ointments. He would then look at ghee, a mirror, the cows and bulls, the Brahmins and the demigods, and see to it that the members of all the social classes living in the palace and throughout the city were satisfied with gifts. After this, he would greet his ministers, gratifying them by fulfilling all their desires. After first distributing flower garlands, pan, and sandalwood paste to the Brahmins, he would give these gifts to his friends, ministers, and wives, and finally he would partake of them himself. By then the Lord's driver would have brought his supremely wonderful chariot, yoked with Sugriva and his other horses. His charioteer would bow down to the Lord and then stand before him. Holding on to his charioteer's hands, Lord Krishna would mount the chariot, together with Satyaki and Uddhava, just like the sun rising over the easternmost mountain. The palace women would look upon Lord Krishna with shy, loving glances, and thus he would get free from them only with difficulty. He would then set off, his smiling face captivating their minds. The Lord, attended by all the Vrishnis, would enter the Sudharma assembly hall, which protects those who enter it from the six waves of material life. As the Almighty Supreme Lord would seat himself upon his exalted throne there in the assembly hall, he shone with his unique effulgence, illuminating all the quarters of space. Surrounded by the Yadus, lions among men, that best of the Yadus appeared like the moon amidst many stars. And there, O King, jesters would entertain the Lord by displaying various comic moods, expert entertainers would perform for him, and female dancers would dance energetically. These performers would dance and sing to the sounds of mridangas, veenas, murujas, flutes, cymbals, and conch shells, while professional poets, chroniclers, and panegyrists would recite the Lord's glories. Some Brahmins sitting in that assembly hall would fluently chant Vedic mantras, while others recounted stories of past kings of pious renown. Once, a certain person arrived in the assembly who had never been seen there before. The doorkeepers announced him to the Lord and then escorted him inside. That person bowed down to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and with joined palms he described to the Lord how a number of kings were suffering because Jarasandh had imprisoned them. 20,000 kings who had refused to submit absolutely to Jarasandh during his world conquest had been forcibly imprisoned by him in the fortress named Girivraja. The king said, as related through their messenger, O Krishna, Krishna, O immeasurable soul, destroyer of fear for those surrendered to you, despite our separatist attitude, we have come to you for shelter out of fear of material existence. People in this world are always engaged in sinful activities and are thus bewildered about their real duty, which is to worship you according to your commandments. This activity would truly bring them good fortune. Let us offer our obeisances unto the all-powerful Lord, who appears as time and suddenly cuts down one's stubborn hope for a long life in this world. You are the predominating Lord of the universe and have descended into this world with your personal power to protect the saintly and suppress the wicked. We cannot understand, O Lord, how anyone can transgress your law and still continue to enjoy the fruits of his work. O Lord, with this corpse-like body, always full of fear, we bear the burden of the relative happiness of kings, which is just like a dream. Thus we have rejected the real happiness of the soul, which comes by rendering selfless service to you. Being so very wretched, we simply suffer in this life under the spell of your illusory energy. Therefore, since your feet relieve the sorrow of those who surrender to them, please release us prisoners from the shackles of karma, manifest as the king of Magadha. Wielding alone the prowess of 10,000 maddened elephants, he has locked us up in his house, just as a lion captures sheep. O wielder of the disc, your strength is unlimited, and thus 17 times you crushed your Asand in battle. But then, absorbed in human affairs, you allowed him to defeat you once. Now he is so filled with pride that he dares to torment us, your subjects. O unconquerable one, please rectify this situation. The messenger continued, This is the message of the kings imprisoned by Jarasand, who all hanker for your audience, having surrendered to your feet. Please bestow good fortune on these poor souls. Shukadev Goswami said, When the king's messenger had thus spoken, the sage of the demigods, Narada, suddenly appeared. Bearing a mass of golden matted locks on his head, the supremely effulgent sage entered like the brilliant sun. Lord Krishna is the worshipable master of even planetary rulers like Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva. Yet as soon as he saw that Narada Muni had arrived, he joyfully stood up along with his ministers and secretaries to receive the great sage and offer his respectful obeisances by bowing his head. After Narada had accepted the seat offered to him, Lord Krishna honored the sage according to scriptural injunctions and, gratifying him with his reverence, spoke the following truthful and pleasing words. It is certain that today the three worlds have attained freedom from all fear, for that is the influence of such a great personality as you, who travel at will throughout all the worlds. There is nothing unknown to you within God's creation. Therefore, please tell us what the Pandavas intend to do. Sri Narada said, I have seen many times the insurmountable power of your Maya, O Almighty One, by which you bewilder even the creator of the universe, Brahma. O all-encompassing Lord, it does not surprise me that you disguise yourself by your own energies while moving among the created beings, as a fire covers its own light with smoke. Who can properly understand your purpose? With your material energy you expand and also withdraw this creation, which thus appears to have substantial existence. Obeisances to you, whose transcendental position is inconceivable. The living being caught in the cycle of birth and death does not know how he can be delivered from the material body, which brings him so much trouble. But you, the Supreme Lord, descend to this world in various personal forms, and by performing your pastimes, you illumine the soul's path with the blazing torch of your fame. Therefore, I surrender unto you. Nonetheless, O Supreme Truth, playing the part of a human being, I shall tell you what your devotee Yudhisthira Maharaj, the son of your father's sister, intends to do. Desiring unrivaled sovereignty, King Yudhisthira intends to worship you with the greatest fire sacrifice, the Rajasuya. Please bless his endeavor. O Lord, exalted demigods and glorious kings, eager to see you, will all come to that best of sacrifices. O Lord, even outcasts are purified by hearing and chanting your glories and meditating upon you, the absolute truth. What then to speak of those who see and touch you? My dear Lord, you are the symbol of everything auspicious. Your transcendental name and fame is spread like a canopy all over the universe, including the higher, middle, and lower planetary systems. The transcendental water that washes your lotus feet is known in the higher planetary systems as the Mandakini River, in the lower planetary systems as the Bhogavati, and in this earthly planetary system as the Ganges. This sacred transcendental water flows throughout the entire universe, purifying wherever it goes. Shukadev Goswami said, When his supporters, the Yadavas, objected to this proposal out of eagerness to defeat Jarasand, Lord Keshava turned to his servant Uddhava and, smiling, addressed him with fine words. You are indeed our best eye and closest friend, for you know perfectly the relative value of various kinds of counsel. Therefore, please tell us what should be done in this situation. We trust your judgment and shall do as you say. Shukadev Goswami continued, Thus requested by his master, who, though omniscient, acted as if perplexed, Uddhava took this order upon his head and replied as follows. Chapter 71, the Lord travels to Indraprastha. Shukadeva Goswami said, having thus heard the statements of Devarshi Narada, and understanding the opinions of both the assembly and Lord Krishna, the great-minded Uddhava began to speak. O Lord, as the sage advised, you should help your cousin fulfill his plan for performing the Rajasuya sacrifice, and you should also protect the kings who are begging for your shelter. Only one who has conquered all opponents in every direction can perform the Rajasuya sacrifice, O Almighty One. Thus, in my opinion, conquering Jarasandh will serve both purposes. By this decision there will be great gain for us, and you will save the kings. Thus, Govinda, you will be glorified. The invincible King Jarasandh is as strong as 10,000 elephants. Indeed, other powerful warriors cannot defeat him. Only Bhima is equal to him in strength. He will be defeated in a match of single chariots, not when he is with his 100 military divisions. Now, Jarasandh is so devoted to Brahminical culture that he never refuses requests from Brahmins. Bhima should go to him disguised as a Brahmin and beg charity. Thus he will obtain single combat with Jarasandh, and in your presence, Bhima will no doubt kill him. Even Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva act only as your instruments in cosmic creation and annihilation, which are ultimately done by you, the Supreme Lord, in your invisible aspect of time. In their homes, the godly wives of the imprisoned kings sing of your noble deeds, about how you will kill their husband's enemy and deliver them. The gopis also sing your glories, how you killed the enemy of the elephant king, Gajendra, the enemy of Sita, daughter of Janaka, and the enemies of your own parents as well. So also do the sages who have obtained your shelter glorify you, as do we ourselves. O Krishna, the killing of Jarasandh, which is certainly a reaction of his past sins, will bring immense benefit. Indeed, it will make possible the sacrificial ceremony you desire. Shukadeva Goswami said, O King, Devarshi Narada, the Yadu elders, and Lord Krishna all welcomed Uddhava's proposal, which was entirely auspicious and infallible. The Almighty Personality of Godhead, the son of Devaki, begged his superiors for permission to leave. Then he ordered his servants, headed by Dwarka and Jaitra, to prepare for departure. After he had arranged for the departure of his wives, children, and baggage, and taken leave of Lord Sankarshan and King Ugrasen, Lord Krishna mounted his chariot, which had been brought by his driver. It flew a flag marked with the emblem of Garuda. As the vibrations resounding from mridangas, berries, kettle drums, conch shells, and gomukhas filled the sky in all directions, Lord Krishna set out on his journey. He was accompanied by the chief officers of his corps of chariots, elephants, infantry, and cavalry, and surrounded on all sides by his fierce personal guard. Lord Achyuta's faithful wives, along with their children, followed the Lord on golden palanquins carried by powerful men. The queens were adorned with fine clothing, ornaments, fragrant oils, and flower garlands, and they were surrounded on all sides by soldiers carrying swords and shields in their hands. On all sides proceeded finely adorned women, attendants of the royal household, as well as courtesans. They rode on palanquins and camels, bulls and buffalo, donkeys, mules, bullock carts, and elephants. Their conveyances were fully loaded with grass tents, blankets, clothes, and other items for the trip. The Lord's army boasted royal umbrellas, chamara fans, and huge flagpoles with waving banners. During the day, the sun's rays reflected brightly from the soldiers' fine weapons, jewelry, helmets, and armor. Thus Lord Krishna's army, noisy with shouts and clatter, appeared like an ocean stirring with agitated waves and timangila fish. Honored by Sri Krishna, the chief of the Yadus, Narada Muni bowed down to the Lord. All of Narada's senses were satisfied by his meeting with Lord Krishna. Thus, having heard the decision of the Lord and having been worshipped by him, Narada placed him firmly within his heart and departed through the sky. With pleasing words, the Lord addressed the messenger sent by the kings. My dear messenger, I wish all good fortune for you. I shall arrange for the killing of King Magadha. Do not fear. Thus addressed, the messenger departed and accurately relayed the Lord's message to the kings. Eager for freedom, they then waited expectantly for their meeting with Lord Krishna. As he traveled through the provinces of Anartha, Salvira, Marudesh, and Vinashan, Lord Hari crossed rivers and passed mountains, cities, villages, cow pastures, and quarries. After crossing the rivers Drishtavati and Sarasvati, he passed through Panchala and Matsya and finally came to Indraprastha. King Yudhisthira was delighted to hear that the Lord, whom human beings rarely see, had now arrived. Accompanied by his priests and dear associates, the king came out to meet Lord Krishna. As songs and musical instruments resounded along with the loud vibration of Vedic hymns, the king went forth with great reverence to meet Lord Rishikesh, just as the senses go forth to meet the consciousness of life. The heart of King Yudhisthira melted with affection when he saw his dearmost friend, Lord Krishna, after such a long separation, and he embraced the Lord again and again. The eternal form of Lord Krishna is the everlasting residence of the Goddess of Fortune. As soon as King Yudhisthira embraced him, the king became free of all the contamination of material existence. He immediately felt transcendental bliss and merged in an ocean of happiness. There were tears in his eyes, and his body shook due to ecstasy. He completely forgot that he was living in this material world. Then Bhima, his eyes brimming with tears, laughed with joy as he embraced his maternal cousin, Krishna. Arjun and the twins, Nakula and Sahadev, also joyfully embraced their dearmost friend, the infallible Lord, and they cried profusely. After Arjuna had embraced him once more, and Nakula and Sahadev had offered him their obeisances, Lord Krishna bowed down to the Brahmins and elders present, thus properly honoring the respectable members of the Kuru, Srinjaya, and Kaikeya clans. Sutas, Magadhas, Gandharvas, Vandis, jesters, and Brahmins all glorified the lotus-eyed Lord, some reciting prayers, some dancing and singing, as mridangas, conch shells, kettle drums, veenas, panavas, and gomukhas resounded. Thus surrounded by his well-wishing relatives and praised on all sides, Lord Krishna, the crest jewel of the justly renowned, entered the decorated city. The roads of Indraprastha were sprinkled with water perfumed by the liquid from elephants' foreheads, and colorful flags, golden gateways, and full water pots enhanced the city's splendor. Men and young girls were beautifully arrayed in fine new garments, adorned with flower garlands and ornaments, and anointed with aromatic sandalwood paste. Every home displayed glowing lamps and respectful offerings, and from the holes of the lattice windows drifted incense, further beautifying the city. Banners waved, and the roofs were decorated with golden domes on broad silver bases. Thus Lord Krishna saw the royal city of the king of the Kurus. When the young women of the city heard that Lord Krishna, the reservoir of pleasure for human eyes, had arrived, they hurriedly went onto the royal road to see him. They abandoned their household duties and even left their husbands in bed, and in their eagerness the knots of their hair and garments came loose. The royal road being quite crowded with elephants, horses, chariots, and foot soldiers, the women climbed to the top of their houses, where they caught sight of Lord Krishna and his queens. The city ladies scattered flowers upon the Lord, embraced him in their minds, and expressed their heartfelt welcome with broadly smiling glances. In various places, citizens of the city came forward holding auspicious offerings for Lord Krishna, and sinless leaders of occupational guilds came forward to worship the Lord. With wide open eyes, the members of the royal household came forward in a flurry to lovingly greet Lord Mukunda, and thus the Lord entered the royal palace. When Queen Prita saw her nephew Krishna, the master of the three worlds, her heart became filled with love. Rising from her couch with her daughter-in-law, she embraced the Lord. King Yudhisthira respectfully brought Lord Govinda, the supreme god of gods, to his personal quarters. The king was so overcome with joy that he could not remember all the rituals of worship. Lord Krishna bowed down to his aunt and the wives of his elders, and then Draupadi and the Lord's sister bowed down to him. Encouraged by her mother-in-law, Draupadi worshipped all of Lord Krishna's wives, including Rukmini, Satyabhama, Bhadra, Jambavati, Kalindi, Mitravinda, the descendant of Shibi, the chaste Nagnajati, and the other queens of the Lord who were present. Draupadi honored them all with such gifts as clothing, flower garlands, and jewelry. King Yudhisthira arranged for Krishna's rest and saw to it that all who came along with him, namely his queens, soldiers, ministers, and secretaries, were comfortably situated. He arranged that they would experience a new feature of reception every day while staying as guests of the Pandavas. Desiring to please King Yudhisthira, the Lord resided at Indraprastha for several months. During his stay, he and Arjun satisfied the fire god by offering him the kand of the forest, and they saved Mayadhanava, who then built King Yudhisthira's celestial assembly hall. The Lord also took the opportunity to go riding in his chariot in the company of Arjun, surrounded by a retinue of soldiers. Chapter 72, The Slaying of the Demon Jarasandha. Shukadeva Goswami said, "One day, as King Yudhisthira sat in the royal assembly surrounded by eminent sages, Brahmins, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas, and also by his brothers, spiritual masters, family elders, blood relations, in-laws, and friends, he addressed Lord Krishna as everyone listened. O Govinda, I desire to worship your auspicious opulent expansions by the Rajasuya sacrifice, the king of Vedic ceremonies. Please make our endeavor a success, my lord. Purified persons who constantly serve, meditate upon, and glorify your shoes, which destroy everything inauspicious, are sure to obtain freedom from material existence, O lotus-navelled one. Even if they desire something in this world, they obtain it, whereas others, those who do not take shelter of you, are never satisfied. Therefore, O Lord of Lords, let the people of this world see the power of devotional service rendered to your lotus feet. Please show them, O Almighty One, the position of those Kurus and Srinjayas who worship you, and the position of those who do not."